Hello and welcome to yet another episode of Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin, and I am not here with Teos Abadia. He is gallivanting around the country, working, sadly. But I have replaced Teos with two wonderful folks, Jason Ward and Dan Dillon. Jason, Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, happy to be here. We can't replace
Teos. Thanks so much for having us.
Oh, I will replace Teos. Believe me, for, you know, in hockey terms, it's a bag of pucks. Is that what it's called? But for now, I want you each to introduce yourself, starting with Jason. Jason, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Jason Ward. I am operating out of Indianapolis, Indiana, home of Gen Con, which is the only reason I'm into gaming, I guess. Not really. I am one half of Accidental Cyclops Publishing, and there is nothing else relevant to speak on.
Okay. Well, until later.
Until later.
Yeah. All right. And Dan, tell us a little bit about you.
Hi, I'm Dan Dillon. I'm a freelance game designer, primarily working on Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition, and I was formerly a member of the D&D design team at Wizards of the Coast.
True story. I saw that.
I was there.
Mm-hmm. There's proof.
You could say you were there. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show. As normal, we're going to stick with our routine, which is the first segment we'll take listener questions, and we will do some news, and then we will kick over to our main topic today, which will build on last week's topic of world building. Yes, build on last week's topic of world building, and talk about making actual mechanical rules to fit the world that you're creating. Because I think both of you have some good insight into that based on your previous work. So let's jump right into our listener corner, starting with Alan Tucker via our Patreon Discord, who says, what do you consider success in the RPG industry? Have you achieved it? And if so, when? Jason, what do you think?
As the least experienced and least successful of the three of us, I got to go first. I take success in sort of two realms, I suppose. The first is, am I successful at creating the thing that I'm proud of? And, you know, am I getting commentary on it that I like? Does it feel like people are enjoying it? That kind of success, the kind that makes you proud and you want to keep designing, right? The probably more important type of success to make sure that you're going to keep doing this work is the commercial success. And those two are often linked, but not always. You can have a commercially successful product that just really isn't well received and well reviewed, but it sold well. And you can have some very good games, many of which I own from Kickstarter and from, you know, bookstores that are not commercially successful. They maybe sold 1,000 copies, but they're just really great games. I would say that, you know, I'm new to the publishing industry. This is really my part-time job. I've been 20 years in the wrong career so far, and I'm trying to make my way into this one. And we've had one successful project that was lucrative comparatively compared to what we expected, and that was the Real Thing RPG, which is based on Powered by the Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. It did in two different Kickstarter campaigns about 2,200 backers and sold some more after that. So it did pretty well, nice. Particularly for what I would consider a zine. We marketed it as a zine and sold it as a zine, and it did very well for us, which allowed us to start moving into some other stuff and made me feel, I guess, competent or confident enough to go in and start working on some bigger projects.
Nice. Dan, same question. What's your opinion or definition of that success?
Yeah, so one definition of success doesn't work for me, much like Jason said, and I agree with his, you know, basically sort of two-pronged definition of it. I want to make games that are played and used and not just read. So if people look at something that I've written and it just ends up on a shelf and they never really touch it again, I don't personally consider that a success, even if they enjoyed it, which I'm gratified for. Like, I'm happy if someone just reads it and enjoys it, but I want it to be played. I want it to hit the table. I want it to see use. So I want people to have fun with it. So that's sort of my personal measure of a successful thing in the RPG world. Commercial success, you know, that's an ongoing thing. I don't think I'll ever be able to say, haha, now I've made it. You know, I've freelanced for many years, you know, did the Wizards thing for a number of years. Now I've moved on from that. So there really isn't a I've hit the bumper. Now I am successful. It's steps on a journey. Mm-hmm. And so I just keep sort of moving forward to the next thing and keep trying to do the next cool project.
Yeah. I have a feeling both your answers are great. Excuse me, are great. So I'm going to flip it a little bit and say, for a freelancer, often success is getting the job. Mm-hmm. And then you just fail. You hope you fail well, but you fail. It's like, oh, I've got the chance to write this, you know, fill in the blank. I've got a chance to work in Undermountain. I'm going to write an Undermountain adventure that's going to be published by Wizards. I've succeeded, and now I get to go fail. And so you fail as well as you possibly can and hope that people enjoy the imperfect thing that you've created, because there is no such thing as a perfect product, this or that. So then you go off and you hopefully succeed at getting the next chance to fail.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what art is like, right? It's failing forward. It's yep. failing better.
There's a lot of learning at every stage.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. That brings up nightmarish quotes from people in my regular day job, which is the software industry, which you're, mm-hmm. again, failing forward and move fast and break stuff, which are kind of just garbage terms, right? It's really just about doing the best you can all the time and learning while you're doing it.
Yeah. I always go back to, there's a Samuel Beckett quote, ever tried, ever failed, try again, fail better. And for me, that's art, right? It's just failing better over and over and over again. But you have to take the small victories when you get them, or the large victories as they come, I guess. So, yeah, good times.
Those keep us going.
It does. It does. It keeps us on our toes or flat on our back, depending on the stage of the project you're at.
Yeah.
And our second question comes in from Torin McCabe via YouTube. We were talking about world building, and Torin says, wow, Sean's thought process is completely different than mine. If I had a nickel for every time I heard that. My first and best bit of advice on world building is to say how your world is like this other world, only with these couple of things changed. And I'm going to start by saying, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That is a fine way to create. Using templates, modeling based on other things. They are great learning tools. They're very efficient. They're very effective ways to create. Great way to build a world, especially if it's one that you're just dealing with your home group. Mm-hmm. However, I would not use that as the best way to describe a world if you plan to market it or publish it. Because what you are saying is, it's just like this world with these two changes. There are very smart people out there, very creative people, and a lot of them DM. And if you say, buy my world, it's like Eberron, except the Dragonmarked houses are crime syndicates and the Warforged are all ruthless assassins. That sounds great. And then I'm going to say, as the DM, you know, I can already do that. I can just make these tweaks. So you sort of need to build the world from the ground up, at least on paper, if you're going to market and sell your world to a wider audience, I think. Thoughts?
Yeah, that's the sharpest distinction to me is what are you building it for? Because if you're building something for a home game, you have a lot more leeway to, you know, just sand serial numbers off and tweak things to your liking, flavor, you know, take bits from here and there, whatever. But if you're actually going to try to market something for sale to a wider audience, you have to make sure that it's distinct enough from whatever you're emulating. And it's fine to be influenced by things. You can take elements that you like about Eberron, and those can influence whatever you're building for your, you know, magic punk world that you that you want to make. But it really needs to be yours. And you can also get into legal trouble depending on how closely you cleave and how many things. I would recommend changing more than two details if you're going to try to do something like that.
For sure. Yeah, I love the way you explained that, Sean. I think to put a bow on it, I would say building the world needs to be a process of self-expression, like not derivative necessarily, because that's more fulfilling in my mind. Explaining a world is often, here are the three things you need to know. Because you're not going to read everything I wrote, and that's okay. There's nothing more disappointing than sitting down writing 100 pages about a fantasy world or a sci-fi world or what have you, and then realizing after the fact that your players don't care. They want to know, how do I jump in and start playing, and how do I make a character that's going to be fun for me to play? Mm-hmm. And so you need to put in the amount of work for world building that's fun for you, and not expect anyone else is ever going to see that or care about it the way you do, unless you're publishing. And then it's a whole different conversation. You have to make it marketable.
Yeah. One of the greatest things I've seen in setting books or setting guides is that, 10 important things you need to know about blank. And so you're not saying it's like this, but not. You were saying it is this. It is this. And even if you're using another world as a template, if you say that, you are denying yourself. That's not denying yourself. It's training yourself not to talk in terms of other things, what it isn't, but in terms of what it is. And that can be super important. This world has rampaging dragons. Lots of worlds have rampaging dragons, but by saying, well, it's like Dragonlance, you're setting yourself up for failure. Just say you have rampaging dragons, and you'll serve yourself better.
By starting with the comparison, you're denying your own world's creation the ability to be its own thing. You're sort of already boxing it in as, Eberron Light or whatever. Just instead of saying that, say magical technology is prevalent, and then go from there, and you can have dozens, hundreds, infinite number of different D&D worlds that use magical technology, but do it in ways different from each other.
Yeah, like, you guys were talking a lot about Shadow Dark on the show lately, and they could have made the misstep of saying it's like 5e Light, because it really kind of is. There's some new stuff in there for sure, but if you're walking up to a player and saying, hey, we're going to play this Shadow Dark game, it's a little bit like 5e Light and a little more fatal, that would probably get the point across to most players. But that's not how Shadow Dark's going to explain Shadow Dark, right? Right. That would be a huge mistake, because it is.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. So thank you for those questions and thank you for those answers. Let's talk a little bit about some news. And the big news that hit my inbox at the end of last week was Modiphius announcing a Discworld role-playing game. It has licensed Discworld for a series of board games, but they are also going to publish a tabletop role-playing game called Terry Pratchett's Discworld Adventures in Ankh-Morpork, with a Kickstarter coming later in 2024. They did not give any details about what kind of rules they are going to use for this game. They are obviously well known for their 2d20 system, but who knows what if they're going to use that or move on to something else. Do you, either of you, know Discworld, like Discworld, hate Discworld?
I'm aware of it. I haven't read the Discworld stuff, unfortunately. It's sort of on my list, but something I was never exposed to early on in life. It just never crossed my path until later. I have some friends who are doing loop-de-loops ever since this this announcement dropped, so Kelly's going to be real excited. Have fun with that.
I'm in exactly the same boat. I am aware of Discworld. I don't know if I was too early or too late in my adopting a fantasy and sci-fi as my go-to settings, because I think it kind of blends the two, if I'm not mistaken. It's a little sci-fi fantasy-ish, in at least how it's been explained to me. It is moving up my list based on the amount of excitement I'm seeing in all the Discord channels I'm in. This seems like something that I'm super, super jazzed about.
Yeah, I've read excerpts, and I've seen a bit of the what is it? There was a live action sort of British production of some of the Terry Pratchett stuff.
Yeah, they've had a few, especially British BBC adaptations. I read the first Discworld book. It was either The Light Fantastic or Sorcery, and I read it in high school based on the recommendation of a game playing friend. And it was the perfect, for my taste at that time, blending of satire and fantasy. It was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but fantasy. And it just struck the exact right chord at the exact right time. And I read as many of them as I could get my hands on. And he came out with a more children-focused series, the Tiffany Aching series. There was the Wee Free Men, Hatful of Sky, and maybe four or five in the series, more focused towards children. So I read those to my daughter. Of course, it was for her. It wasn't for me. It was for her. And they're, even though they're more young adult, children's focused, they're still witty and insightful and all of the things that I love about literature and games and fantasy. So when I saw this, my first thought was, oh, cool. And my second thought was, I don't know if I want to play this game. And I sure as hell don't want to design this game. Because
yeah, that's daunting.
Yeah, it's so good in the medium that it's in that trying to make a funny game is so difficult. Trying to make a super witty game is so difficult. And the world is still cool and fun and funny and satirical and in all the best ways. I just don't know how it's going to translate to a role-playing game.
One of the great things about reading satire and cleverly written things is that it's controlled. It's like watching a great comedy sketch. It is when it's performed well, it is the perfect thing. And then you put it at your table and hope it goes well. And then you realize your players are your players and they're going to do what they're going to do. They're not necessarily going to play witty and satirical. They're not going to embrace that world. And then even if it's a really well-made game, it might just not feel right when you start playing it.
And even in its own medium, satire can be very hit or miss. I mean, just look at the resurgence of the discourse around Starship Troopers and things like Warhammer 40K, and if they are good satire or if they have missed the mark of satire and are harboring nastiness and humanity in their spaces. So you have to tread carefully when you're dealing with things like, well, this needs a certain amount of media literacy, or you have to get it to get the message it's actually bringing across. And then when you translate that to a game, what sort of mechanics are going to be happening that incentivize you to certain avenues of play? And there's a whole lot to consider there, and I'm interested to see what they do with it.
I would say, Sean, remember you said success in this industry is really about getting hired for the project, though. So if they call, I expect you to say yes and then make a game that you're not proud of. As you said, you failed, right?
This is the one thing where I would probably go, I couldn't do it. I mean, Acquisitions Incorporated was one thing that was funny, but it didn't have the sort of gravitas behind it that this does. I don't know. I wish whoever works on it, wish them well. Especially if you're going to be designing a new rule system to go with it. If you're using 2D20, then you've got that. We'll talk about this later. You've got that solid base there. Trying to make your, and then if you're going to have board games with it, you may want to tie that to a board game, and the wheels go round and round, and my brain is already having I'm having anxiety literally right now, and I'm not even working on the game. More power to them. Speaking of new games, Daggerheart, the Critical Role. Yeah, the Critical Role. What's the company that Critical Role?
Darrington Press.
Thank you. Darrington Press will be publishing Daggerheart, and you can play it starting March 12th in the open beta. You can find everything you need to know about this playtest at daggerheart.com. There's going to be a few different ways to do this. One will be go to the Daggerheart website where you can get the PDF material that you need. You can print it if you need to. You can also go to partners of Darrington Press and Daggerheart, Demiplane, which will have a character creator via their Nexus, or DriveThruRPG, where you can get the role-playing game material. Have either of you read anything about this, play tested previously? They've discussed the Hope and Fear dice that they're going to have and a card system for creating your character. Any experience, thoughts?
Only the vaguest sort of discussion and people posting on social media that they happen to be at a like a con event where you could jump into these sort of early play tests where, you know, one of the designers was there running something. Mm-hmm. So I don't know a whole great deal about it yet. I'm interested to see what it does and how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have very little exposure, only what I've read over the last few days. When they announced that, I went and looked and I was like, oh, I didn't realize this was this far along. And I heard on Elder's Lorecast that this was happening. So I went and did some digging and I'm intrigued. I love the math of games, and I know they're using a 2D12 system, and I'm like, okay, let's see. Is that going to be actually mathematically interesting, or is it just you're rolling D12s on tables or something like that? So I'm interested to play a little bit of the playtest materials and see what they're doing with that more than anything else.
Yeah, it's the if I remember correctly from when we covered it a long time ago, it's each of the D12s represent a different thing. One represents hope and one represents fear. So if you succeed on the hope side, you still succeed, but it means something. If you succeed on the fear side, it means something. And I'm intrigued by melding mechanics with narrative elements rather than just have, okay, you succeed, so therefore the story moves forward, as opposed to you succeed in a certain way, or the way you succeeded also speaks to something on the narrative side of either your character's psyche or how the success is perceived by others, or, you know, those sorts of things. And I'm so intrigued by that. But like you say, Jason, the math needs to work.
Yeah.
And if it's just that, if it's just, okay, hope, though, therefore you tell me something hopeful, but the math underneath it doesn't work. It's again, anxiety as game designer.
Yeah.
For me, it puts me in mind of the Genesis system, the one that was used for Star Wars Edge of the Empire with their, you know, all their different little sort of axes on their special dice that can mean different things, where you fail, but you get this good thing that happens even though you failed, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
My experience with playing it, while fairly limited, so, you know, just take that in mind, is that seems challenging to be able to sort of adjudicate all of the different things that can mean for every role that happens for every session of a campaign that could last, you know, how long. So that's my big curiosity, is how well will this hope and fear, and what do these different sorts of success or failure mean, and how easily is that communicated to the GM and the players, and how easy is that to do something with, to weave it in and make it be a thing? Or is it something that is just more often than not going to be left behind in favor of, well, I rolled and succeeded, or I rolled and failed, we move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of what you do with some of the Powered by the Apocalypse games, where you succeed with a consequence. And those consequences are written very generically. You know, you succeed at some sort of cost, or you put yourself in a bad situation or something like that. And that leaves a lot of room for interesting story. But as a narrator, as a storyteller, you have to be quick on your feet.
That's a lot of load. That's a lot of cognitive load. Blades in the Dark does similar stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, when they're writing the books for Daggerheart, are they doing enough coaching to make it fun, exciting, and really interesting or unique? Or is it going to be left up to the table, and it gets left behind, as you said, Dan?
Yeah, guidance and tools could go a long way here. I'm interested to see what they put together.
Yeah, it's when you think about designing a game, often you have in your mind, as the game master, like the best game master you ever had, right? It's like, oh, this game master who's great, they will be great at running this game. And you never, or you often forget to write a game that the worst game master you ever had will be able to run.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here, right? It's like, I sat down with my family to run the Star Wars game. And I wouldn't say I'm a great game master, but I'm an experienced game master. So I was like, okay, here we go. Roll the dice. And it, as Dan said, it comes up with, oh, you failed horribly, but you had a great breakthrough.
Triumph, it's, or whatever. Yeah.
It's like, okay, there's only so many times where you can either succeed wildly, but have a, you know, have a drawback, or fail horribly, but have a triumph that you just run out of run out of story
beats. That's exactly it.
Yeah. So that, as you said, Dan, cognitive load gets quite extreme while you're trying to do it.
Yeah.
So and the card-based system also intrigued me. I don't know. I assume that you were aware of fourth edition, even if you didn't play it. But people loved cards. They loved to print out their own little power cards. They loved to buy power cards. So that was something that people seemed to like. And this game seems to be at least leaning into that a bit with card-based character building, like backgrounds and things you can place on. Any thoughts on that or how they're going to use that?
It's intriguing, and I've always been kind of enamored of card-based character creation mechanics ever since Deadlands. I love Deadlands, and I love how you make characters in that game. You use a poker deck, your regular deck of playing cards. You draw a number of cards, and the suits and values determine your statistics, and it's so cool. So I just don't know how they're employing the cards yet. Mm-hmm. You know, fourth edition used them not as like a core mechanic, but as a companion tool, right? So that's a different way to approach it. Whereas, you know, in Deadlands, when you roll initiative, the marshal shuffles a deck and you get a card based on how well you drew, or a number of cards. And then that determines your order in the round by the value of the card. Yeah. So
in my mind, the cards are going to be great as long as they actually become a compelling component, not just something you could have done as part of the die roll. So they need to be a necessary addition or influential in some way that the dice couldn't also do. And, you know, is it just adding complexity for complexity's sake? Because I guess mm-hmm. would be my problem.
Yeah.
The problem that you could run into there is that becomes a potential barrier, right? That was an issue I had a lot of players run into with the Genesis dice, the Star Wars dice. They needed to buy these bespoke dice. They couldn't use any of their, or they could, but it was a pain to have like a translation matrix for your D8 and what symbols the numbers would have. That, you know, right. that just doesn't work as well. So it depends on what the cards are, what's on them. Do you want them to be able to be reproduced with dice in a pinch if people don't have access to those cards? You know, but then like, what's the point of cards if it's just essentially rolling on a table? So yeah. Execution is going to be a big one here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My big question about this release was, what could it mean for D&D, for fans mm-hmm. of D&D, for the market of D&D, if Daggerheart's super successful? Because I know there is a you cannot dismiss out of hand the number of people that are into D&D because of Critical Role. It's not 50%, but it's not 5% either, right? And so what kind of impact does this have, do you think?
Yeah, my thought is, as popular as Critical Role was, as many people as it brought to the game, there is still a much larger percentage of D&D players out there who have no idea what Critical Role is. And so I hope it does well, and I hope it brings people into the hobby for the sake of the hobby as a whole. But even I think if it is wildly successful in its own right, it doesn't tip the market much in terms of 5th edition D&D or the 2024 edition of D&D.
I'd agree with that assessment. Critical Role, it wildly popular. If Daggerheart kind of follows that success model, that's fantastic, and I really hope it does. I wish huge success for everybody who works on it, because more games, more better. But just given some of the things I've seen, both observing as a fan and from my time in Minas Renton, I don't think the impact will be that significant on D&D itself as sort of a business or fan base factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of feels to me like it will maybe bring even more people to D&D if it goes well, because they'll see there's the bigger world out there of role playing games. It's not just
it'll bring, you know, like both of you said, bring people into the hobby, and that's all to the good. And go play lots of games. Find what you love. Play those.
Yeah, this is such a niche hobby. even as it's grown exponentially in the last 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, it's still a niche hobby. And I'm always looking, who's going to be the on-ramp? What's going to be the on-ramp for new players? And that means advertising. That means, you know, cultural cachet. Yeah. It means a lot of things. And I would love it if it wasn't just Wizards of the Coast / Hasbro who had to bear that burden of bringing people into the hobby. I would love it if some really huge, you know, powerful force in the industry, in culture, in business, was able to bring new people in as well. I think that would be great. I just don't know if Critical Role, as large and wonderful as it is even enough to move the needle in that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at how big gaming has gotten, and it's like, as far as the entertainment industry, tabletop gaming is still just a rounding error.
Sadly, but true.
Yeah.
But what's not an error is the D&D dev update that we saw come out recently, where we learned about new features for the D&D Beyond maps.
Very excited about those.
Oh, yeah. What did we get? First of all, maps. I love maps. Maps is the thing that I wanted 20 years ago. Just to put a map up and to move things on the map and let my friends move things on the map so we could play from a distance without having to get a master's degree in computer science. And so that came out to pretty popular reviews, pretty good reviews. And now they're updating things, including new draw and pointer features, so you can draw on the maps or put pointers on the map. They already have Fog of War, but they are updating it to make it easier to use. There will be a spectator view, so you can see what the other people that you're playing with are seeing as the game master. They've updated tokens. They've added more maps. They talked about the new third-party release, Humblewood. So we've reported on that a couple of times, so that's available. And you can watch that dev update on YouTube following the link in our show notes. Thoughts on maps and how you've used it or what you think of it?
Go ahead.
I was saying, I have used D&D Beyond for about 3 years now, COVID, right? And I have really liked the character creation aspects. I like being able to reference the things that I have bought in there and use those rules. It has some issues in my mind, but it is a very solid platform. I have never used maps. I didn't know this existed until Sean told me about it a week ago, right? They have a map thing on there. And so I need to play with it. I'm excited to give it a try. Unfortunately, my only standing D&D game is in person, no electronics. We are paper and dice, which has been great. It's been a great throwback to, you know, being in high school and college, but it means I don't get to play with D&D Beyond anymore. And my subscription is going to waste, but.
Yeah, so I've been using it. I've been running Turn of Fortune's Wheel and using maps for it, and it's freaking fantastic. It's what I want in a virtual tabletop. It's very simple, it's very clean, it's very intuitive. I could just pick it up and go. It's missing a couple of features that I need for it to feel like I've got it. This is what I want, and this is what I'm going to run campaigns in. It's almost there. Adding draw and pointers and some of the quality of life stuff with tokens helps. So, like, now I can take a token, rename it to something. What I really want is map pins. I want to be able to, like, here's a point of interest, and now I can do that by renaming a generic token, right? Mm. The draw function is great, so I can, you put spike growth down. Here it is, right? So feeding from that, I want area effect draw tools. I want to be able to just be like, here's a 20-foot sphere, whatever. Right. Once you have that as a tool that you can just kind of drag and drop or click and drag to you know, spread and angle around to see what the cone hits, then in my mind, it's going to be perfect. And that's everything I need. I don't need all the hyper extra bells and whistles that various platforms are doing, which, again, I wish them all the success in the world for their audience that wants that stuff, but that audience is not me.
Are they 2D only right now? maps on.
Yeah, maps is 2D. Oh, yeah. Maps is 2D.
And that's another interesting thing is, right, it's we're getting maps, but we're also at least theoretically getting a 3D virtual tabletop.
That is called codename Sigil or Sigil, however you want to say it.
And it's, you know, it's in tandem, not in tandem, but maybe separately, it seems like, almost being.
They're not the same thing.
Yeah. So I'm happy with that because there are people that just want the 2D. There are people that are going to want the 3D. So I'm glad that we're getting these tools in whatever way we want to use them.
Yeah.
I will tell you, I will move on to this. If one of you can tell me that on a token, you can tell me, you can label it how many feet in the air it is.
I haven't played with the like you can change its name. So if you want, you could just add the elevation as a, as in like a suffix on the end, you know?
Yeah.
This is a very salient point for me. We were in a baby Red Dragon's lair with our low level characters, and it was all over the place height wise, and no one could figure it out. And I was like, all right, there's got to be a tool for this somewhere.
Got it.
Now you know.
Got it. Yeah.
Now you know.
Yeah, there's all kinds of risers and stuff for when you're playing on a tabletop, but yeah.
You need to make a small dog, put a dragon suit on it, and just set it on the table.
My dog is Tarrasque size if we're using regular miniature.
Okay. Awesome.
Little too big.
I was going to say, Archie, would Archie wear a...
Yeah, I could probably put some wings on Archie. And...
All right, there you go. So check that news out on the D&D Dev Update. And last but not least, for our Creator Corner, we are going to talk about something near and dear to our hearts. We are going to talk about Surviving Strange Hollow, which heads to Kickstarter on Tuesday, March 5th. Which means, due to the magic of podcast time, it's tomorrow, but it's also yesterday or even sooner. But by the time you hear this, it will be up, it will have launched, and you can check it out at get.accidentalcyclops.com or just go to the Kickstarter. Very excited about this. Jason is on the team that is the publisher. Dan is going to be a rules designer on this book. I am going to try not to fail too much in my parts, and you know, very very excited to show you more as this Kickstarter progresses. Any quick notes, Jason, on that?
Yeah, we're just my business partner and I are just very lucky to have gotten you two, but also the other, you know, amazing designers and writers on this project. We're approaching it in a different way. I think it's going to allow everyone who's on the team to shine in their own ways. You know, people that are specialized in, say, writing fiction, we've got fiction to be written in this project that's going to be really stellar. We're leading with the art. Emily Hare was the artist. We had 95% of the artwork for the book done before we started imagining any rules or stories, which is just really crazy from a publishing standpoint. You never have that. So we're really
usually goes the other way, right? And then you have this weird process where you have to go back and change words to fit art, because it's at a certain point you can't really change the art anymore. So I'm excited to design things to spec for the art that already exists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. We kicked around a bunch of ideas that are, you know, pre-design, I would say, and Dan's going to tell us how bad they are and make them all way better, which is going to be great fun. Sean's the lead designer, and his team are going to be writing a lot of fiction, but also wrapping that fiction into some of the game design, which is going to be just, I think, a ton of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. And that actually leads beautifully into our main topic this week, which is building or changing rules to fit your RPG world. So last week, Teos and I tackled the question of world building, specifically on building a brand new world for a role-playing game from the ground up, or possibly from the heavens down. And one of the topics that we covered last week was the rules. If you choose to use an existing rule set, you need to be aware of how the rules themselves dictate what the world you are building will be to a greater or lesser extent. So as we were talking about that, that brought to mind a related topic that has been on my mind a lot recently, and on my computer screen quite a bit, which is, what do you have to consider when you're building or modifying RPG rules to fit the world that you're building? And that's why I wanted to have Dan and Jason on to talk about their experiences and their thoughts with this topic. And I was going to break it into three categories, which is using existing rules for non-D&D games, which Jason has experience with, then building new rules for your world, and then using 5e rules for your world. And that'll cover a lot of the interests that a lot of our listeners have. So, starting with existing rules for non-D&D games, there are several rule sets that you can license that are made specifically to be adaptable to different settings, genres, and worlds. The Real Thing, which is used powered by the Apocalypse, did exactly this. Yeah, and a little holding up there for good measure. What was that experience like building this rule set for a world based on the lyrics of a popular band?
Yeah, it was really, it ended up being the only way to go. We started this project knowing we wanted a narrative focused game and we were going to build our own mechanisms. We actually had some of them designed, some rule sets designed, and we got deeper into the project and we were talking with Faith No More, the band, and figuring out what is it that they do or don't want to be front and center on a game that's about their music. And we just really landed on picking a very slim, story-driven, character-driven system, and it doesn't get much better than Powered by the Apocalypse when you're trying to do that. It was a lot of fun. I mean, the system that they have in place, the 2d6 system with the success, failure, and mixed success, is a really strong method for telling stories, I think, particularly when you want player involvement in telling those stories. And we just decided to lean into that and give even more power to the players. And we invented, the only really new thing we did in this system was create a discovery mechanism, which was you create your character's backstory when you fail. So you get to write a part of the story about the history of the game, the world, when you fail. That's the benefit to failing, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's also the experience that you get. You gain an experience point, you mark a discovery, and you tell a story. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be really powerful. It fits with the philosophy of the music we were working with, which was very reflective and introspective and those sorts of things. And I don't know that I'll ever want to create a rule system again because it is so much work and I've done it so many times to no avail. When there are these great tool sets like Powered by the Apocalypse, Fate, obviously 5e is a great sandbox to work in. So yeah, I loved it.
Dan, do you have any experience with outside of D&D?
Yeah. I mean, I've played all kinds of non-D&D games. I tinkered around with using the old D10 White Wolf system for other non-specifically White Wolf and horror games. Because it's, you know, whenever you have a dice pool, target number, build successes, do the thing. And, you know, you can really flavor that. That can go wherever you need it to go, right? It really comes into the nuts and bolts of how you define what actions are and how those work within that system. So that's a really easy way to take a game concept that doesn't already have its own system, take another one that you know, and then just change the text, you know, attached to the mechanics to fit whatever you're trying to do. And something simple, you know, using dice pools, target numbers, gathering successes to do the thing is a pretty simple way to do it. Mm-hmm.
And the math on those D10s is so great. It's just so easy to
Yeah. You just really easy.
Almost like back of your mind, you can figure out how successful you're going to be ahead of time. It's great.
Yeah. It gets weird when you have ones canceling successes and all of that. That makes the math tricky, but
Yeah. I've worked on a Fate game, a Fate system called Part-Time Gods of Fate. It was based on another game that had its own system called Part-Time Gods. And we said, we should update this for Fate. And the Aloy LaSanta, who made the original game, said, sure, go ahead. And we kickstarted it. And it was so much fun because part of Fate is often building the world as you build your character, right? The aspects of the Fate characters are often tied to each other or tied to the world. And with the system that we created, and it's also other games have used this, where you tie your character to specific locations that can have a game mechanical effect on your character, what you can do if you're in your home base, or if you're close to your home base, or if you're far from your home base, different things can happen. But as you're building your character, you're also building the world, which is a cool way to tackle world building in a way that you know will draw the players in, because the players are doing some of the work for you. Jason, you were saying, you know, half the time you build this stuff into your world, the players never see it. If they're building it, they're going to see it.
Yeah. You mentioned Microscope last episode, I think, or two episodes ago. That's a great one to pair with Fate when you're building a world and a group of characters. I love using one or two sessions of Microscope and then jumping into a Fate campaign. They just marry really well.
Yeah. It's like Microscope. You can just take the aspects from Fate and just plug them right into the things you're creating, the events or the periods or even the overall world. It works out very well.
Yeah.
So we have a whole array of systems that are meant to help you build the world as you play the game or as you create characters. Sometimes you may have a world where you want to make rules yourself. The first thing to note, as Jason has already told us, it's great when it works, but it's so much work. So much work.
Making a whole system from the ground up is very, very hard.
The simplest of systems is difficult. And then trying to create anything beyond that is... It's like having infinity laid out before you, and you have to pick a strand without really being able to see the end of the strand. And you do your best, and you end up moving in so many different directions and designing and redesigning and testing and redesigning and redesigning that it should only be tackled if you have a lot of time, a super clear reason for doing so, and a lot of friends who can give you feedback. What are your experiences with creating new systems or tackling it in that way?
For me, very minimal. A friend of mine and I, mostly him, me, just sort of peanut gallering and providing feedback every now and then. He was tinkering on creating his own sci-fi system. He eventually just sort of drifted away from it because it kind of got to the point where it's like, this is really challenging to make it work, fun, and have the staying power to play more than one short session, right? And that's the thing for me is when I play a role-playing game, I almost always want campaign play. One shots are great, you know, short runs are fine, but the core of a role-playing game for me is the ongoing multi-session meeting, however, you know, often you do. And not every game holds up to that sort of play very well. And so it's difficult to hit all those notes correctly when you're making your own system from the ground up. And it depends on how unique you're trying to be, because there are a lot of systems out there, and you're going to find that a lot of the things that you would just sort of try to do have been done in a lot of ways and have had a lot of those burrs filed off already. So maybe you're just better off using one of those that's more refined.
I've got two thoughts here. One, I don't know how many times I've created a system and gotten 75% of the way through it and realized I can't play test this enough to know if it's any good. Yeah. And I'm never going to have the time or the number of people that are willing to engage in that with me. And then someone will publish something, or I will find something that's already been published that is also 75% of what I wanted. And I'm like, I guess I'll just use that then.
Right.
It's happened a lot over the years, particularly as more and more indie games are getting published. I'm finding I will back almost any $20 indie game just to see what cool thing they're doing and see if I can pull something from it at this point. And there are some really great ones. The other thing I was thinking as both of you were talking is Sean, you mentioned the complexity issue. It's one thing to make a simple game, it's another thing to make it complex or to add the complexity. We've seen that happen in real time over the last 50 years. Dungeons and Dragons is that, right? It is AD&D, which is what I started with, was a messy set of systems. It wasn't even one system. There were percentage parts when you were a rogue. You were going to roll low on a 20 here, you want to roll high on a 20 here. And it was this mishmash of tables thrown in for fun. And it's really a bunch of game mechanisms mashed together to form a system that is pretty not great. I'm going to make some people mad saying that, but it's unrefined. It is a game, but it is an unrefined game in my mind. And they spent the next three editions refining it. And is it perfect? No, it's never going to be. We've talked about that already. But they've made it a simpler system that still accomplishes all the same things if you just give it a chance, right? I don't know anybody who, in their right mind, likes the idea that rogues have a percent on something that is only affected by what level they are. And it's arbitrary and weird. And we fixed it. We created athletics as a skill that works just like everything else, right?
Now you can actually climb a wall if you're not a rogue.
Climb a wall.
Sorry.
And you don't have to be 13th level to be good at it,
It's, I mean, I always tell people that AD&D was the most amazing game. It was terrible, but it was amazing.
So
Right,
much
as a
fun.
game, it spurred all of this. But if you sit down and it's not really playable as written, in a lot of ways. So, you have to understand that it's not slamming the game. It's just that was the technology they had back then, and now we've got better technology to do the things that that
I
game
mean,
did.
even just going to second edition AD&D made it so much more playable and functional as a game. But even you look at that, THECO worked, but why would you do that when you figure out addition is faster and easier? Like, it was fine. It worked. It's what we had at the time. We played it, we had a blast.
We did.
We wouldn't do it now, I hope.
There are people that still do,
Oh,
and
well, oh yeah,
more
sure.
power to them, for sure.
Absolutely.
But I stand by my statement that D&D has been refining this whole time. And there have been missteps along the way, but by and large, thanks to people like Dan Dillon, it's a better game than it was in 1987.
And that brings us to the final part of this talk, which is using 5e to build the rules for your new world. 5e is obviously well known among the audience of tabletop role-playing games, so it's often a good idea to use that. Because it is well known, there is a little caveat there, which is if you need to change any rules, if you need to tweak rules to fit your world, you are treading on a little bit of dangerous territory because people are used to the rules being the rules. And if you tell them that they can't do this thing that they've been doing for 15 years in their games, you may get some resistance. You may get people unwilling to suspend their disbelief in that way. So that's just one caveat, but that is generally assuaged by the popularity and the ease of use and the ease of modifying the system to do what you need to do.
The big thing for me there is, if it's the system that you love playing and want to play, by all means use it for whatever world or theme you want, right? Just, understand that it does what it's good at, and go in with that in mind, and you're gonna have a great time. I mean, look at the Star Wars fan creation, fan made Star Wars 5e. If you need to see that in action, you can check out Dimension 20's show. Oh, I'm blanking on the title of it. Star Stuck Odyssey. That's it. Watch that. It's on YouTube or on Dropout if you have a Dropout subscription. If you don't, it's worth it for Dimension 20. It's great. But you'll see sci-fi 5e. Esper Genesis does awesome sci-fi 5e, right? there's a lot of different things you can do with it. You just gotta understand what you're playing with.
Yeah. Well, and to the comment about people getting upset about, you know, making exceptions or changes to that, those core mechanisms, I think it's arguable, and Sean, in our show notes today, you've argued that there, even published material has said, yeah, but don't do it here because of story, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see it in the things like Critical Role and the other shows that you can watch online, where they are making their own rules and creating their own exceptions. And I think as a culture, or as those shows like that are changing the culture in a way that is making it acceptable to say yes and during sessions when you want to change rules, when it fits a story and when it makes the situation more fun. And so I know when I was playing in 1997, if I would say, well, it's not going to work that way this time because I don't want it to, as a storyteller, as a DM, people would be mad because they memorized the book and they knew how it was supposed to work. I don't think that's the case anymore. Maybe it's just all the people I play with have matured, or maybe, like I said, I think it's a cultural affectation of what we're seeing, the more narrative-driven role-playing. I think people are open to things changing and playing with the rules a little bit.
And as you put it, I think that's not so much of a yes and, it's a little bit more of a no but, right? It's like, no, you can't play a paladin in this setting, but you could do this thing, which is similar-ish, right? It'll hit some of the same flavor notes that you want, but fits with my conception of how divine magic works, whatever. And I think that is tricky if you're going to remove elements that people would expect from a game, but as long as you get buy-in on those elements from the players beforehand, you know, you should be fine, right? As long as everyone is informed about what's going to be dropped or changed, at least in a general sense, then they can make the assessment if that game is for them. And if it's not, that's okay. Like, every game isn't for everyone, and that's all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've set that all up with session zero.
Yeah, exactly. Very important.
Yeah. And I think it's helped when the actual publisher of the game does things like that. Right.
Yeah.
So when Dark Sun came out, and people were, the second edition, people were, well, I'm going to play a paladin because I only play paladins. And then the DM's like, well, you know what? There are no paladins in Dark Sun. And why not? Well, it says it right here, and I hold up the rule book where it literally says there are no paladins on Athas.
Right.
Period. end of section. That's it. Yeah. And so to be able to do that, to be able to tell different stories and change the rules in that way can lead to upset, but it can also lead to some really cool stories. It can lead to some really fun and updated mechanics, because while there were no paladins, there were Templars. So it was remove this, add this, and here we go. It's going to be a little different story, but... I think we're all going to enjoy it.
And also the halflings are cannibals, so have fun.
Yeah. Well, and they weren't necessarily cannibals. They just had the peculiar palates.
Fair enough.
And that's the thing, is there's a lot of stuff that you don't necessarily have to throw out. You just have to reconceptualize how you're presenting it. Dark Sun is a great example of this, especially with the paladins, because paladins function inherently so differently in fifth edition than they did in previous editions, where paladins in fifth edition don't have to have a connection to a god. That's not where they get their power from, right?
Yep.
They get their power from their oaths, which many of them are devoted to gods through temples or whatever, but they don't have to be, in the class doesn't assume they are. So it's like, Templars of the Sorcerer Kings could be paladins. Maybe Templars could be warlocks, right? Who have made a pact with the Sorcerer King and drawing on that power. So there's a lot of different ways you can think about how the things in your world could interact with the existing rules. And you can just try to set aside some of your base assumptions of what those things might be and find ways to make the existing stuff work if you're worried or don't want to cut something out entirely. I know I have had conceptions in games where I'm like, oh, I'm not going to do this or allow this stuff because I'm running a game with this flavor and this sort of cultural style. And someone says, well, I really want to play this thing that, you know, okay, that doesn't fit. I can make it fit. Let's recast it, right? You know, and there's ways you can work with your players to make it happen and not compromise the vision of the world you're building.
Yeah, and that's one thing to do as a DM. It's another thing to do it as a publisher of a new setting and new rules that you hope are going to catch the imagination of game masters and players. And part of that is, while 5e has classes and has backgrounds and has species and has those things, at its base, there is the game loop. At its base, there is this, you roll the die, you add a number, you compare it to targets, and then a thing happens. And so 5e does things well, but it also does things not well, depending on the narrative that you're trying to extract at the end of the game loop. I have a list, but I want to hear y'all's take on sort of what sorts of experiences, genres, etc. does 5e do best. And I want to focus less on the genre, because fantasy, sort of self-explanatory, but sort of the experiences of storytelling and gameplay. What do you think 5e does best, or maybe doesn't do quite as well?
I mean, at its core, D&D is designed to be a heroic fantasy game, right? You are heroes opposing evil, fighting monsters, and exploring often dangerous locations, right? And you know, that stuff. So that is, it's very simplistic and sort of general, but that's what it does well, right? That's what it's built to do.
Yeah, and it's always been that, right? I mean, I don't think there's any, it has evolved to allow a lot of other things that it's good at now too, but it is still at its core a game about tactical violence.
Yeah.
And a lot of what you might want out of a game doesn't necessarily have to be, or isn't in a lot of cases, represented by mechanics that are for that, you know, for the heroic fantasy side of things. Like a lot of the just storytelling and interaction, you get by with very minimal mechanics in a lot of those. I know some people like heavy social mechanics or these intricate sort of backs and forths and matrices, or, you know, tracking this, that, and the other to convince somebody to give you a potato. I find that overly cumbersome. I find it deeply immersion breaking, I suppose. And I reserve that sort of stuff for the big elements where you have to convince something of something crucial that is not at all something that they would normally want to do. And it might be a thing that you have to sort of work on them over time to sway them to your side.
Yeah, if I want my cerebral and social challenges to be as meaty as my physical challenges, I will play Burning Wheel. And I rarely play Burning Wheel.
There you go.
Speaking of games meant to be read but not played.
hey, I've played a lot of Burning Wheel, and it can be fun, but it
isn't. I'm not saying it can't be fun, but trying to get through the process. I'm covering role-playing games with my class. We just started like small role-playing games, simple role-playing games, one-pagers, because a lot of them know D&D, but they don't know anything else. And have you ever heard of the Terrible RPG?
Terrible, right? Terrible. Yeah.
You write your skills on a sheet of paper, and then in order to succeed, if you use that skill, you have to tear a letter out of the word that's on the sheet, and it has to be big enough to cover this small square that's on the rules. And if you do so, if you make the tear correctly, because there's a process, you can't do certain things while you tear. And if it covers that little square, you succeed. And if you do an illegal tear, or if it doesn't cover that, you fail. And so I was running this with a class of 20 students. And so I was like, okay, we did a Nick Cage, like Russian agents are turning US folks into zombies, and they come into our classroom. But you're a super secret agent, so they made their character sheet. I'm like, okay, what do you do? And they, I use my karate and I, okay, oh, you did. And it was just, okay, you have taken down this agent. Boom, done. It took 10 seconds. And they didn't really realize you could play role-playing games that way, because it's always been roll the die, compare it to a number, look at the hit points, look, you know, where are you standing, all that sort. And so that's a game that is super fun to play. You could play it in an hour. You can make characters in a minute. And it moves at a pace that 5e does not move at, right? Because of these micro, I always call them microtransactions, but there's such a negative connotation to that. And I don't mean it negatively, right?
Yeah.
It's just, it's small steps.
There's a lot of minutia.
Exactly, exactly. And so if you are making a game that tries to embrace quickness, tries to embrace fast-paced storytelling, you either have to do something different with 5e or go to a different game. And there are games much, much slower than 5e, don't get me wrong. But, it has a pace that is pretty set.
Yeah. And depending on your proficiency and comfort with the system, there's a lot you can do to change that. Mm-hmm. But that does get into messing with sort of the guts of the math of the game, and you're sort of just taking your life into your own hand, you know, your metaphorical life into your own hands when you start doing that. So I applaud people who want to do that. Good luck. Mm-hmm. But you can change things like hit point totals to where you can complete battles that quickly, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But it's set up to be, you know, this cooperative team tactical experience where, yeah, you have to work together to bring down these threats. So mm-hmm. that's very different than each secret agent taking out an enemy spy.
Right.
Like that.
D&D embraces the randomness in that way, right? So if you decide you want to mess with the amount of randomness you have in a game, you better have a lot of buy-in. So there are lots of hacks out there for how to speed up combat and make it so that you just start comparing numbers and going down the chart essentially during a combat. You go through initiative and it's like, I did 10 damage, I did 4 damage, and you just keep going, right? It's not as fun for everybody because a lot of people really love the experience of rolling the dice and taking 3 minutes to do the math that should take 3 seconds, but sometimes it takes a lot longer than you want it to, right?
Yeah.
The other thing is, like, with something like the Terrible RPG, that gets into an interesting, like, your manual dexterity comes into play here.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are some people who are kind of just selected out of being able to effectively play that game, unless mm-hmm. there are other ways around that. I don't know. I haven't read it in depth. I looked at it ages ago when it came out. Like someone who, you know, if their hands tremor or whatever, right, they don't have that sort of fine motor control, that's maybe not the game for them, and that's, you know, there it is. And so that's sort of a downside. It's a reality of, and something that you need to consider if you're using a resolution system like that instead of just picking up and rolling a die.
I've found in my experiences DMing for a lot of different people that one of the things that players really don't like, even if they begrudgingly accept it, is having anything detrimental done to their character other than hit point damage. Mm-hmm. So being stunned, being at disadvantage, tends to make players of 5e grumble or just outright pout. I'm not even going to bother attacking because I have disadvantage. Have any of you noticed that in your experiences?
Not to that degree, really.
Okay.
If I get to the point where someone is sulking because they have disadvantage, and that's just sort of how they play the game, that is going to be a reassessment on my part of, is this a person that I want to play D&D with? Things like stunned, I more get that. If you're stunned or you get, paralyzed by a ghoul or whatever, that can be a real bummer when you're sort of taken out of the action. Depending on a lot of factors, not the least of which is how quickly does your group's combat rounds play? Because I have some groups that go lickety split, and it's not a grueling 17-year wait for my turn to come back around, and I can try to shake off that paralysis and get back into the fight. I've had other groups where it's like if my character gets debilitated at the start of the fight, I know that like, okay, well, I'm not participating in this one because it takes so long to get through these rounds that we're just not going to get back to me.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Dan there. I haven't had very often, at least not recently, anyone that got overly emotional about a situation like that. I mean, there's obviously there's some disappointment. It's like, man, I'm gonna miss a round. That sucks. And that then makes people jump on their phones and all kinds of other things that become worse about the game, right? But yeah, by and large, I think that people are pretty accepting of if they can do it to the enemy can do it to them.
What about, here's an example. What about exhaustion? Right? Exhaustion is one of those things where it could be such a useful thing. But almost immediately it puts something on the player that seems so insurmountable that it just sort of shuts everyone down. And is to what point do you as a player or you as a game master need to just accept that as the game? Or you can see I'm struggling with a lot of game design stuff here, where I want cool things to happen to the characters that aren't just hit points, that aren't just you lost 10 hit points. But there seems to be just a resistance at some points.
Exhaustion is a great point. I love the concept of exhaustion, and I want to use it more as a DM and a designer. And I often design things that apply exhaustion, and I almost always end up scrapping it because, unfortunately, the massive tendency is if a single level of exhaustion, sometimes just a single level, gets slapped on people. And multiple for sure, that's almost an adventure day ender, right? As soon as that encounter is done, if they are at all able to, they will stop what they're doing, waste whatever's re left of the rest of the day, and then take a long rest to get rid of that exhaustion. I want to be able to use it. I want it to be a better tool. Unfortunately, the actual user experience, I don't think matches what the design hope for it was, and that's just my supposition. I wasn't around when that was designed, so I'm holding on to a tiny shred of hope that maybe the playtest exhaustion will come back around and maybe see the light of day for the 2024 rules revision. Even though it was announced that it was not making the cut, I'm hoping that that reverses course and we get to see it because that version of exhaustion, I think, is more of what I want, more of a usable tool.
Yeah, and it's that was for anyone who doesn't remember, that was one level of exhaustion minus one on your D20 checks. Two levels minus two on your D20 checks. And for I love that. I like, okay,
And
that's
to
much
your
better.
spell save DCs.
Okay, there you go. And then I was like, okay, at what point does at minus two do people start to get antsy about
And
it? At
that's a good
minus
question.
four, do people start to get antsy about it? At minus six, do people start to get antsy about it? And I was like, I would love a survey. At what threshold does your brain shut down and you decide I don't want to do this anymore? At what minus?
Yeah, because I know where this question's coming from because of some of the work we're doing on Strange Hollow, I'm gonna take a little bit of a different bent on this. And I like things like exhaustion because they make things that were not going to be challenging, challenging. So you can, from a resource management perspective, throw things at a group of first level or second level exhausted characters that they would normally wipe the floor with, even when they're almost out of resources. But because they're exhausted, that then becomes a challenge that can be fun for the story. It's like, oh, now I see why goblins are deadly, right? Because sometimes when goblins are fighting you, they have the distinct advantage of having slept through the night and you don't. And, you know, it's little things like that that can make story elements introducible even to a party that you couldn't normally introduce them to, because you have toned them down, even though they're higher level than what this encounter would suggest they should be.
Yeah, that one, I struggle with, because I get what you're saying and I agree and I want it to work that way. In my experience in play, it doesn't. All it does is kill the pace of the game, because now the party wants to stop and rest. So you have to build in a timing mechanism or a device of some sort that says you have X long to complete this adventure. Spend your rests wisely, right? And so that then becomes a design and game running challenge to kind of keep that pace.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's another one of those things, because rest is a resource. And so how do you manage that as well?
Right.
And that's some of the stuff we're tinkering with Strange Hollow. Is this place is so foreign, so alien, so strange to you. Strange, I didn't mean to do that. That rest is hard to come by in places, right? Certain places. And that's the way it should be in a dungeon, right? I want to take a long rest. Cool, we bolt ourselves into a room. Well, I don't know that I'm going to let that slide every time. You know, I meant this to be a resource challenge. It's going to be a resource challenge, even if I have to break what I was going to do because you decided to barricade yourself into a room.
To do that right, I think you need the guidance, right? And probably some tools for the DM to use to help give that weight and just show the DM, how do you do this? Because that is a thing you can definitely leverage. And like one of the variant optional rules out of the Dungeon Master's Guide from 2014 is the rest variants, right? Mm-hmm. Where one of them is a short rest takes, you know, overnight, and a long rest is a full week. That changes the pace of adventures immediately and tells you that battle is a serious commitment. If you commit to a fight, you need to like square with, you might be out of commission for a month.
Yeah. That's interesting. I forgot about those rules.
Yeah.
These are the sorts of things that we're wrestling with when we use 5e to try to tell particular stories in a particular setting with particular narrative juice to it, to make even the detrimental things fun for the players. And how, and even if the player doesn't care about story so much, how to make it mechanically fun and different and put a twist on it so it becomes more palatable, if not enjoyable, to play a game using some different rules.
Yeah, and some of that might be giving, some of those tools that Dan talked about giving are things you can do even though you are exhausted, or new things you can do with your action if you are stunned, or, well, maybe not stunned's a good example, but paralyzed, something along those lines, where you are somewhat reduced in ability. Disadvantage is a good example. You're reduced in ability. You don't want to risk attacking. What can I be doing otherwise that provides value, but more importantly, is fun for me to stay engaged?
Yeah.
Right.
So we are hitting the end of our show. But I want to, first of all, thank all our listeners out there. I hope you have enjoyed the expertise of both Jason and Dan. Thank you, whether you're a Master of Dungeon supporter, a Master of Realm supporter, or even a Master of the Multiverse. We thank you so much. Jason, where can people find you and your work on the internet?
Yeah, I try to stay away from the internet. No, that's only somewhat true. You can find Accidental Cyclops, our work, at accidentalcyclops.com. You can find our Kickstarter, as we mentioned earlier, on Surviving Strange Hollow on Kickstarter now, when this comes out, up through April 4th, I think, will be the last day. So watch this before then. If future you can tell past you to make sure you watch this on time, make them do that. Otherwise, find us at Fun with One Eye, I as in the organ, because Accidental Cyclops is one letter too long for the naming conventions of social media platforms. So Fun with One Eye.
All right. And Dan, how about yourself?
Yeah, on the internet, you can find me on the app formerly known as Twitter at Dan_Dylan_1, and I'm on Blue Sky at Dan.Dylan, I believe. So, yeah.
Awesome. You can find the show, all the places, YouTube, podcast. I already said YouTube. You can find me on Twitter and all the other places at Sean Merwin and the show at Mastering D&D. So until next time, we are going to go kill it on Kickstarter.